Welcome to Homeschool Companion, your source for information, motivation, and inspiration. If you're part of the homeschool community or simply interested in learning more about home-based education, stay tuned. Together, we'll examine the latest resources, learning styles, and teaching techniques. We'll speak with experts in the field to help you uncover every homeschool advantage. We'll also present suggestions on how to keep Christ in the curriculum as we explore fresh ways to teach and learn. Here's your Homeschool Companion host, author, educator, and children's ministry specialist, Dr. Rose Gamblin.
Welcome, welcome. I'm here with Dr. Crystal Witten. She has a lot of letters after her name. I was just asking her prior to our conversation here what she has: PhD, MS, LD, and RD. So what does RD stand for?
RD is Registered Dietitian.
Registered Dietitian. And then LD is Licensed Dietitian. And then your master's you got in
Nutrition.
And then your PhD was in?
In Nutrition and Molecular Biology.
And today I thought it'd be great to talk about nutrition in our brain, because I imagine that nutrition has a huge impact on how our brain functions. So, Dr. Witten, just explain a little bit about the parts of the brain.
Okay. When we look at the brain, we see five different regions. We see the frontal lobes, and the frontal lobes basically start around your eyebrow going up. Then we see towards the back, the occipital region. There's the limbic region and several other regions.
Now, do different foods affect each region differently? Should we just focus on one region?
Nutrients impact the brain at all levels. We're talking the brain needs a constant supply of glucose, and for the most part, it respires 100% on glucose, meaning that's the primary fuel, unless you go into ketosis. And once you go into ketosis, the brain can respire on ketones, and it actually can be very beneficial, causing certain biological resets in the brain.
So when you say respire, you're talking about what the brain needs to function?
Yes, ma'am. So when the brain, it doesn't respire or use 100% ketones, so it would still be a combination, maybe 20-30% ketones, and the rest would be from glucose. But the research that I did, I worked with neurons and applied different types of stressors to the neurons, and when I did that, the neurons had been pre-exposed to ketones. There was quite a bit of protection against, let's say, a chemical that would cause epileptic type activity in neurons. And so if I expose the neurons to ketones, they were really impervious to epileptiform type activity.
So I, of course, then want to have that protection. What are some of the ways I can get that protection for my brain?
Well, it's very interesting. There's several different pathways to ketosis. The first pathway is to go on a ketogenic diet. And the ketogenic diet is probably the most extreme diet in the world. When we're talking about the classic ketogenic diet, it's 90% of the calories from fat. And the fat, the backbone of that would be heavy whipping cream and butter.
Wow. So someone would have to literally eat cubes of butter or whipping cream?
That's correct. But I have, as part of my research, developed a vegan ketogenic diet, but have not really tested it. But it should perform just as well as
whipping cream. Okay, so this type of diet, I mean, you probably wouldn't stay on it forever, but this type of diet has some protective factors. What are you suspecting? Maybe your research didn't indicate all the protections, but what are you suspecting that it how it protects the brain?
We believe that ketosis in the brain causes something we coined a biological reset. So when the brain has to respire on ketones, they're more highly reduced than glucose is. And so the brain actually loves ketones. It loves to get these ketogenic acids. So what we believe happens is, at least in the case of refractory seizures, So especially for small children, infants and small children, they're very easy to treat. I won't say easy to treat, but they respond very well to ketogenic diets. So what happens is the ketosis, when they go into ketosis, very robust ketosis, their seizure threshold goes up. And
now, when you say threshold goes up, that means they have less
seizures? They have fewer seizures, yes. So anyone can have a seizure. You could have one, I could have one, but we have a high seizure threshold. If we were to get a high fever or, you know, there's many different causes of seizures, if we were to be exposed to some of those causes, we would have a seizure. But because our seizure threshold is high, naturally high, we don't have a seizure. And so what ketosis does is it resets that threshold to a higher level.
Now, I, as a layman, always thought ketosis only came about when someone went on a pretty restrictive diet and then their body went into ketosis. Is that the same thing?
There's different degrees of ketosis. So, for example, if you eat a meal at 5 p.m. and you don't eat again till 7 or 8 the next day, say at breakfast time, you've gone about 14 or 15 hours without any food. So you'll be in very mild ketosis. And that's the point of breakfast. It's breaking the fast. And so when you eat breakfast, you now have broken your mild state of ketosis. That level of ketosis is not necessarily going to reset the seizure threshold. It would need to be a longer time fast. And like I said, there's several different ways to get to ketosis. One way is with a high-fat diet, and that's what we call the classic ketogenic diet. It's 90% of the calories from fat. If you want to use medium-chain triglycerides, that would take the fat down to 80%. And the other way to get to ketosis is to fast. And when you look at Jesus, the fasting, he fasted 40 days. That was very powerful, strong ketosis. And that probably really fine-tuned his brain functions, so he was able to resist the devil.
So the idea of, you know, let's say a child has, you know, started having seizures. Is there benefits from that nutrition, or does it depend on what part of the brain the seizure's coming from?
It somewhat depends on which part of the brain. We're looking mainly at temporal lobe, temporal lobe epilepsy. But there's a lot of factors that go into it. It's definitely worth an experimental trial because some children have up to 120 seizures a day.
Yes.
And even medicines don't help. Sometimes surgery doesn't even help. But if you look at the data on ketogenic diets, it's actually the most effective treatment for refractory seizures, but it's not very commonly used.
Yes, I've never heard of it before.
Really? It's very difficult to implement. It takes several days of training the parents. And even with the training that goes on, they still need almost daily contact with a registered dietitian to make sure that they're staying on track and not introducing any. The child would get very few carbohydrates, and so it would be really critical to keep them under a certain amount of carbohydrate.
Now, how does a parent give this high-fat diet and not end up with a very fat child? I mean, there's so much about obesity that, you know, that's scary for a parent. They think that the fats come from fat.
It's very interesting. As long as you control the calories, the high-fat diet will not make the child fat. The main concern has been, does it contribute to elevated cholesterol and LDL? And those concerns are legitimate concerns, but we haven't really seen any negative long-term effects of this high-fat diet because of, I believe, the benefits far outweigh the negatives.
Yes. So you've developed a vegan diet. So what would those fats look like?
We use a lot of coconut fat.
Coconut.
So a lot of coconut fat. It's, like I said, it's just theoretical. It's on paper right now, and I've never known anyone to implement a vegan ketogenic diet. It doesn't mean it hasn't been done. I just haven't seen it in the literature.
Well, for those of us that might watch, you know, these shows where people go and survive, these survival shows, and they eat whatever they can find, a lot of times they're eating coconuts or the heart of palms and things like that that do have these good kind of fats in them. And they're fasting too. So.
That's right. They might eat one meal a day, which that would put you into ketosis. So if you eat one meal a day, it takes your body about 3, 4, 5 hours to digest a meal. And then for the rest of the time until your next meal, you're probably maybe starting towards very mild ketosis. And certainly 10, 15 hours after a meal, you're going to be in slight ketosis.
Yeah, so fasting in itself does have some benefit to the brain.
It really does. There
and
are many
that's amazing.
Benefits. Yes.
So for a parent who wants to have their child perform the best in school, what would you recommend that they feed the child for the to optimize their brain function?
It's always important to consider your body as a machine. So if your body requires, say, 2,000 calories, you want to give it around 2,000 calories. And you want to also choose the best fuel sources. And so children are a little bit different. I like to approach each child individually. There's not necessarily one way that works for every single child. But for a very active child, for example, they may eat a meal at 7 in the morning. And if they're very active and they're playing and running, they may need a snack by 9 or 10 o'clock. And what happens a lot of times is our blood glucose is stored in our liver as glycogen. And glycogen is what keeps our blood glucose level very stable. So we can pull glycogen out of muscle and liver and keep that very level. But a child has a very small liver compared to an adult. So we can go for 5, 6, 7, 8 hours between eating, and we have enough glycogen in our liver to keep us going and not to give us those hunger pains that we feel when our blood glucose begins to drop. But a child doesn't have that. And so it's very important to make sure that a very active child does get snacks. And I know I don't recommend adults eat snacks. I consider snacking to be a fat habit. But for a very active child, they may require snacks.
And you know, this just is, I know I have to take a break right here, but I want to talk about diabetes. So we'll take a break, and then when we come back, I'll talk about that. We'll be right back.
Here's Dr. Rose Gamblin with the Mind Matter Minute.
Are you right-brained or left-brained? An easy way to find out is to cross your arms. Is the right arm over the left arm? If so, then you are most likely right-brained. The right half of your brain controls the more creative side of you, and the left half of your brain controls the analytical side. This popular interpretation of the brain, though, ignores the complex interactive reality of the two sides working together. While understanding the brain's hemispherical roles is important, we can't categorize people as left-brained or right-brained. It's better to be whole-brained, don't you think? It sure matters to your mind.
Mind Matter Minute is brought to you by MRG Media Ministry. For more information on topics about learning, go to mrgmediaministry.com. That's mrgmediaministry.com.
Welcome back. I'm talking with Dr. Crystal Witten about nutrition and brain food and just helping our young people function well at school with the proper fuel. And I promised you that I'd talk to her about diabetes. I know that as a teacher, I have had children that were diabetic, and we were constantly monitoring it. Every 2 hours, they took their blood, you know. So this situation with a diabetic, how do I make sure, first of all, that I don't already have child onset diabetes, you know, as a child, make sure that I'm not setting my child up for that. You know, here you're saying to give them snacks, but how do I make sure that I don't set them up for some serious lifestyle problems later on?
Very excellent questions. Let's differentiate between type 1 diabetes, which is insulin-dependent diabetes, and type 2 diabetes, which is basically you've gained so much weight that your pancreas is now unable to put out enough insulin to cover your glucose needs. So if we can exclude the type 1 diabetics initially here and just talk about type 2 diabetics. Type 2 diabetes is basically the result of being overweight or obese. And for example, women, when they become pregnant and they start gaining weight, which is normal during pregnancy, but even a normal weight gain during pregnancy can cause type 2, it can cause something we call gestational diabetes, which basically means your pancreas is capable of putting out X amount of insulin. And then when your weight gets past that threshold at which your pancreas is capable of producing insulin, once you pass that threshold, you now are going to need to supplement some insulin or do something to limit the requirement that your body has for insulin.
So I want to give my children the best opportunity to have the best body, the best brain. And so what does a whole child health program or regime look like for me as the parent?
Excellent question. So again, each child is very different. They have different needs. You can have two children from the same set of parents, and they're each one going to have different needs. So, but I'll try to be very general. I think it's a great question. So in my opinion, I'm a plant-based dietitian, and so I approach all of my meal planning from a plant-based perspective. And if the parents eat dairy and eggs and meat, then I try to minimally work that in to meet their needs. But I do prefer plant-based nutrition, which is just plants, 100%. So the first thing to do is to look at the child's health. Do they have any health concerns? How is their weight? And we typically would chart their height and their weight and do serial calculations and look at a linear, look at a graph on a chart, a growth chart. And if the child is tracking in their percentile and they're not considered overweight or obese, we have a little bit more flexibility in working with a child. But for a child that might be obese, and depending on their age, what I want to do with that child is I want them to grow into their ideal weight.
Mm-hmm.
And that might mean not gaining that much weight. And so we're going to feed them really good nutrition. We're going to match their calories to how many calories they need. And we're going to watch their weight, probably weigh them about once a month, and then chart their weight on the growth chart. And then from that point, just kind of watch their height go up. And hopefully their weight will smooth out, and over a period of, you know, several months to a year, hopefully they'll be in a track that would be at a normal weight. So that would be the first thing, is to target a certain number of calories so they're not gaining a lot of weight but growing into their weight.
I'm talking with Dr. Whitten about nutrition, education, learning, and all of the things that we want so much for our children. I think of myself as the teacher, and I've dealt with children with epilepsy and children with diabetes and children with obesity. And you kind of touched upon that when you said you like them to grow into their weight. Mm-hmm. So you wouldn't recommend putting a child on a diet, per se?
Not necessarily. So there's a concept that we need to discuss, and that's the concept of caloric density. So if someone wants to gain weight, you want to eat high-calorie foods, high-calorie dense foods at the beginning of your meal. That would include things like nuts and seeds. If you want to lose weight or not gain weight excessively, then you're going to put your low-calorie dense foods in your stomach first, and that would include things like fresh fruits and vegetables. So you would put in fruit. Maybe they would eat a banana or an orange or an apple before a meal. And then they would have a salad. They would have some legumes in the salad. They might have some green beans, and you might do a vegan macaroni and cheese. And so they've started out with fruit. And I do, if you want to eat fruit with a meal, have it first and wait about 15, 20 minutes. Let that fruit let the digestion process get going. So we're not necessarily mixing fruit and vegetables. And then, you know, a few minutes later, you can have a salad with some fun ingredients. You can put raisins in it, pumpkin seeds, garbanzo beans, lettuce, tomatoes, lots of different fun foods that kids, will eat. And then you pair that with something that kids love, macaroni and cheese. And my macaroni and cheese has a cashew base. So I put cashews, red peppers, nutritional yeast, garlic, maybe a little tomato paste in mine, some water, and blend that up and serve it with macaroni. And kids love that meal.
Yes. And they can go. Do you have any recipes on your website at buildabetteryou.us?
My website is in the process of being built up, but there will be recipes on it.
So keep that in mind, buildabetteryou.us. This is Dr. Crystal Witten that I'm talking to. And we only have a few minutes of the show left, and I know that nutrition is always a huge thing. Most schools in early childhood, we give a morning snack, but it's usually something like fishy crackers or something that's salty and just basically nothing. No, really not really good nutrition. What would you recommend that would be a better, healthy alternative snack?
That is a great question. I would personally do something like a nut-based granola bar. So you could put nuts and seeds like pumpkin seeds, sunflower seeds. You could put, a lot of kids might be allergic to peanuts, but you could certainly use almonds in there. And you can mix it with some honey and or maple syrup. If you wanted to put a little bit of melted chocolate on that or melted carob, you could throw in some dried cranberries or raisins, and it is a perfect snack because the fat in the nuts and seeds is going to make their blood glucose level very stable for a number of hours, and so that will hopefully prevent any hunger pains from the glucose dropping.
Well, we've come to the end of the show. Do you have one last word of advice for parents as they're sending their children off to school that you could share with us?
I think one of the most important things is to make sure your children are developmentally progressing. So if you're following a plant-based diet, it's really critical to make sure they get enough of the B vitamins. Riboflavin is especially critical because if they're not getting milk, most Americans get their riboflavin from milk. Vitamin B12 is also a very critical nutrient to make sure they have a vitamin-based source of both riboflavin and B12. All of the B vitamins are important. I typically recommend almost everyone I see individually take some kind of form of B vitamins. And I like B-complex 100, and I usually recommend adults cut it in half, and for children you cut it into quarters, and they can take a quarter of that every morning.
Yes, and that's such a small thing, and it makes such a huge difference with mood, behavior, concentration. It's amazing. I thank you so much for spending this time with us. Please go to the website buildabetteryou.us. It's all spelled out, buildabetteryou.us. And I have been talking to Dr. Crystal Witten, and she is an expert in the field of nutrition. Thank you so much. I have one last thing to say, and that is God bless.
You have been listening to Homeschool Companion, a production of MRG Media. Be sure to join us on Facebook. Just type in the name Homeschool Companion. For more on this or to contact us, go to mrgmediaministries.com. That's all one word, mrgmediaministries.com.